Hi, this is Bill Arnold. Missed a show or need me talking to help you sleep tonight? I have several solutions to that situation. Here are the podcasts from the show. You are the best for listening and supporting Faith Radio. And a warm welcome to Afternoons with Bill Arnold. It is Monday. I love Mondays. I'm glad you are joining me today, and I hope your Easter weekend was spectacular. And I hope you had a great time worshiping the risen Savior. The tomb is empty. I was looking at Romans chapter 1, verse 20. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. Rebecca was mouthing that as I was saying that. You must know that as a memory verse, do you?
It's been in my head for a little bit, for
That's
a few years.
Standing. Well, anyway, on the show today, we're going to be joined by my friend Patrick Albanese, who will be with us in just a few minutes, and then Sheila Heen is going to be joining me as well. And if you had tense conversations over the weekend, you know how families get together and maybe groups of friends, and you find out that you're in difficult conversations. Sheila Heen is my go-to person. She's outstanding. So we're going to do the first hour with Patrick and Sheila, and then Vince Miller's coming in. We're going to talk about his new book in hour two. That's a great day all ahead. We'll take a short break and be right back with Patrick.
I'm Neil Stavem with a word of thanks to all of you who partnered with us during Spring Share. The Ministry of Faith Radio continues to grow through more signals, more listeners, more online interaction, and more impact for the gospel. And it's all because of your generosity and willingness to join with what God is doing through the relevant Bible preaching and family-focused teaching, helping us all to connect faith to life every day. For the hundreds of friends who gave to support Faith Radio, thank you and God bless you. We're honored by your love and dedication to this ministry.
How do we stay rooted and build up in Christ as Colossians 2 encourages? Faith Radio has a resource that can help you strengthen your faith, trust in God's promises, and rest in His presence. It's the Faith Radio Prayer Devotional email that will come to your inbox each Monday to encourage you with a quote to reflect on and a prayer to begin the week. Sign up for the Prayer Devotional email today at myfaithradio.com/prayer.
What would you do with a brain if you had one?
Do? Why, if I had a brain, I could
while away the hours, conferring with the flowers, consulting with the rain.
And my head, I'd be scratching while my thoughts were busy hatching if I only had a brain.
I always enjoy on Mondays talking to my friend and colleague from prestigious West Des Moines, Patrick Albanese. He's joining me once again. Hello, Patrick.
Hello.
And how was the Easter celebration with your family? All went well?
No one got hurt. As Good. You know, that's my minimum criteria. It was great. The service was great. We did the people have figured out. They figured it out. For years, we've gone to the 7 a.m. service. They actually have a sunrise, 6:26, depending, you know, on the year. But they the early service, we've been going, and the parking lot's empty, and you stroll in, and then you when you're leaving, the people that are lined up for the 9 o'clock service are already in a mood, you know?
Yeah. It's moving a lot of people.
It's moving a lot of people.
Yeah. Did you have about 5 services on Sunday?
Well, 5 Saturday, 6 Sunday.
Oh, wow. That's busy.
So there was about 2,300 people at the 7 a.m. service this time around.
Mm-hmm. And did the pastor, Pastor Mike, did he preach a kind of a warm evangelical message because he assumed that many people brought relatives or friends that might not go to church regularly?
Yep.
I think that's so wise. I think there's a lot of people today who had that experience, who brought a friend or family member, and they heard the gospel in a real clear way. And the big question is, how do we follow up with them? Keep those seeds going.
It was an emotional service. And, you know, and he had talked about, he says, you know, most people think, you know, Christianity is about Christmas. It's about Easter. And he said, don't get me wrong. Christmas is big. It's up there. It's in the top two. But, you know, it finished with we have a very talented singer that is a member of the church, and he was on The Voice last year, got almost to the very end. And he came on, he's singing in the names of all the people. You know, it's interesting. They start the beginning when the church began, and they had one funeral. And then he watches the years roll by as the church grows. And he was talking about, he says, you know, it's great you have this growing church, but this is the downside. You do a lot more of these.
Mm-hmm.
And you see names up there and you're moved, and it was just a marvelous, not only gospel-based message, but, you know, certainly making the case for Christianity. It was wonderful. And there were some quirky things too, you know, that I noticed for the first time. They're reading the Gospel of John 20, you know, where they're discovering the tomb.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, for some reason, the wording had never really caught me before, but it did this time. So the Gospel of John, he says, you know, Mary Magdalene comes running, right? She comes to Simon Peter and the other guy, the other disciple. Can't seem to recall his name, but I do know that Jesus really loved this guy a lot. And then you realize he's talking about himself. I thought, was it just that the grammar rules weren't in place there? He goes, do I say Simon Peter and me? Do I say Simon Peter and I? Me and Simon Peter? Now, you know what? I'll just write down, she came to get Simon Peter and the guy that Jesus really loved. I don't know why it jumped out at me yesterday, but it certainly did. Marvelous service. I take it you had a great one, too.
I had a great one. I love the Christmas and Easter services for that very fact, that you hear a very clear gospel presentation. And I'm sorry, I never, ever, ever get tired of hearing a simple, clear gospel presentation, because I always want to be equipped to share it myself, one-on-one, wherever I can. Or if I'm speaking in front of a group, I always want to have it fresh in my mind. And every time, you know, I hear it, I usually add one other thing to the quiver of things to remember when you're presenting the gospel. And for a lot of people, my pastor said on Sunday that a lot of people are bothered by this inherited sin. You know, that was somebody else's responsibility, not mine. Don't saddle me with that, you know.
I'm sure we're all accumulating plenty.
That's what he said. You know, okay, just look at your own stuff. The times you have lied or whatever. Look at your own sin. It doesn't have to be anyone else's. It just be yours.
Yeah, I'm sure in the parking lot today, alone, you might have thrown one or two out there.
Yeah.
I also love the minutia that comes in, and things you have to understand from a cultural level back at biblical times, of course, like our pastor was talking about. Hey, you know, Mary Magdalene's the first one there. And you have to understand that back in that era, that's the last person you would trust. You wouldn't trust a woman in that position, because their opinions or thoughts or observations weren't counted equal to men's. And yet here it says in the Bible, it's giving this account from Mary Magdalene, and they don't stray from that. And you'd think of all the iterations of the Bible that you would say people had to kind of come across that passage and go, you know, wouldn't it carry more weight if it wasn't her, if it was a guy? But they don't change it. They don't change it. They go, but this is how it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to think to yourself, why did God do it that way? Well, it's an attention grabber.
Well, not to mention she had a history of mental illnesses and demonic possession. So the fact that Jesus probably cast demons out of her as well, and her testimony would not be considered in public opinion.
And yet, you figure not over the centuries, they've been able to say, do we want to tidy this up? Absolutely not. Leave it the way it is.
Yeah,
That's the word.
I mean, even if you look at the Garden of Gethsemane, where, you know, the hero of the story is saying, is there a way out of this? I mean, if it was written by man, I don't think man would be putting it that way. The fact that all scripture is God-breathed and God is the author of every word in the Bible, as he inspired men to write down his words, it is spectacular to think that it is the way it is.
It is spectacular to think it is the way that it is. And it is also one of those things that always makes me say, every word, every single word, that you can't casually read the Bible and just say, oh, that was interesting, because it is. But there will be a word, and then I love those sermons that say, well, now hang on a second. You have to understand the context of that word from its translation at that point in time, and suddenly this whole new world opens up, and you say, you know, the Bible is a lot thicker than you think it is, as big and thick as it is. I love those details. I enjoy them so much.
It's spiritual quicksand. Once you get in, you just keep going deeper and deeper and deeper, and that's when it gets fun. That's when I can't get enough of it.
Yeah, that's actually when it's the most enjoyable, because you say, oh my, look at this is, and also, for me, it adds a so many levels of credibility to the documents themselves, because you say, how could they possibly have known that 2,000 years later we'd be reading this and figuring out all the deep, the depth and meaning that they put into things contextually. You just say, my gosh, you can't make this up. This had to be inspired.
Absolutely. So our recommendation from Patrick and me is to say, don't jet ski across scripture. Get on your tanks and go scuba diving.
Yeah, go deep.
Go deep. Go deep, deep, deep.
You know, as my son will tell you, the Titanic's in 12,000 feet of water, but the Britannia is only in 400 feet of water. Why don't they bring that up? That's my daily conversation with my 8-year-old lately. He's like, I don't understand why they don't bring that up. It's only 400 feet down. I'm like, oh, I'll check into it, son. I'll check.
Let me give you something to do. Yeah. All right, before we go to break, then, what was your Easter brunch? What did you have?
We did the traditional ham. We were at my mother-in-law's. We were going to do it. No, we weren't going to do it here, come to think of it. somebody else. Yeah. I'm talking to somebody else.
It was a big day for ham yesterday. Ham everywhere.
It was a big day for ham. Yeah, and she overdid the mashed potatoes. So we have, a 5-gallon tub of mashed potatoes. Please take some potatoes.
Yes. And if you go to any grocery store today, you probably can't find cloves anywhere. They're all sold out.
No, but here's the thing. When do you ever buy cloves other than the day before Easter?
Probably not. All right, let me take a little break. I got several news stories I want to talk to you about. Patrick Albanese is my guest. We'll take a short break and be right back. Welcome back to the show. I'm always glad to be talking to my friend Patrick Albanese from prestigious West Des Moines, and as we are just sort of getting our Monday started, and I love Mondays, it's nice to be thinking about the Easter weekend and the resurrection of Jesus. And as we start our week and I look at some of the news headlines, again, it troubles me, because before we went to break, we were talking about how important words are, and there's no words that aren't absolutely intentional in Scripture. And then I open up the news and I see things like this poor 5-year-old boy that was thrown off the 3rd-floor balcony at the Mall of America. CBS News chose to say child who plunged from Mall of America.
Yeah, really? As if it just some sort of plunging just happened.
And what is a plunging, and what happened, and why he was thrown? Why do we whitewash this?
What elevated him to the status of being plunged? Did he trip? Did he fall? I mean, you think, why would you even – not only that, but I always thought newspapers went for the more dramatic, and you would think a headline that said, boy who was thrown from a balcony seems to be improving.
Yes.
Because it just seems more dramatic to me. But plunged, I don't – it seems so intentional. And you think, do people really sit around and say, gosh, I have to soften that a little bit? But, you know, ever think about when you're writing just an email, a letter, or a post-it note? In my case, I write a lot of post-it notes. How you choose your words pretty deliberately. And that sometimes you say, gosh, this word sounds a little bit more harsh than that word. And so it's fine. You edit and you change the words around, but you're doing it for a reason. So it makes me think, well, don't the newspapers do it for a reason? Did they look at the possible headlines? Well, what happened here? Oh, this is the kid that was thrown off the balcony. Ooh, I don't like the word thrown.
Mm-hmm. Because that would suggest who threw him and why.
Yeah, because you think if you're just going to be printing a factual statement, a boy who was thrown from a balcony is improving. Those are the facts.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly you say somebody played with the words and said, I just don't like that wording. And so you want to ask, well, why did you change it? What was it you didn't like about thrown? We all know it happened. It's, you know, you could have said allegedly thrown, I suppose. But I know it's sort of disturbing. But you start to realize they do want to shape how you feel and think about things.
Yes. So words are important. Let's stay on the words theme. Over the weekend in Sri Lanka, there was that attack. Interesting, the word choices used by certain politicians.
Yeah, and it isn't just that one used it. It's the fact that so many, instead of saying Christians were attacked, they said Easter worshipers. Now, of course, you know, in all honesty, I think most people know that somebody worshiping Easter is a Christian, don't they?
I would think so, but I don't know what's so terribly wrong with the word Christian.
Well, I'm just throwing an opinion out there. Maybe it's just that by stating the truth, it sounds like a group was targeted. When you say Easter worshipers, that could be anybody, anywhere, most likely at a church or something like that. But if you say Christians attacked, you say, oh, that group was singled out. They singled out a group.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they don't want people to think along those lines. But, you know, in the New Zealand attack at Christchurch a month ago, they were pretty quickly say this was, you know, Islamophobia. This was an attack on Muslims. And it was. They were perfectly happy to say what it was, you know, a little over a month ago. And that's was what it was. The guy who carried out the attack said, I am singling out Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
But this attack, Christians were singled out.
Yeah. And staying on the word theme, Patrick, there was an article in The Guardian that talked about the dad who gave birth. And I go, no, I flat out reject that premise. There's no such thing.
I don't understand, again, and that's I know we talk about this a lot. What is there, this, I don't know what you would call it, their desire to have people parrot a lie? Because you say, I understand this is somebody who's transgendered and possesses the female equipment, enough of it to give birth to a child. And you're saying a man gave birth. It's like, no, I'll even grant you transgendered man. But you can't say transgendered man for some reason. You have to say a man because that's how this person wishes to be identified. But you say, but that's not the truth. That isn't the truth. I don't think a bunch of men are going to wake up the next day saying, you know, I never knew I could get pregnant. I did not know.
Right, right.
You did not, as a man, give birth to a child. You are a transgendered man who has all the biological equipment of a female, and you gave birth. That's the truth.
Mm-hmm.
why does that step on toes? Why is that offensive to people?
I don't know. What's, you know, most people who are listening are not offended at all. It's just the liberal secular world that's offended by that.
Yeah. And I think to myself, do they really believe it themselves? Or
they
is
can't.
It just
they
fun
can't.
Thing
it's
they
part
like
of an
do?
Agenda they're promoting. I think they can't believe it themselves.
But unfortunately, people get beat up if you don't toe the line anymore. So that's isn't it equally disturbing that we have to take these pauses and then we have to have all these little caveats in our speech saying, now I'm not saying this or I'm not saying that. But I'm saying this over here, but don't take it the wrong way. I understand. I mean, I just did it, you know, 310 times as we were talking about this story. We have to put all the caveats in there because we don't want to have the mob come after us and say, you are a so-and-so phobe. You're a phobophobe. You fear everything. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you are in the heart of the voting land because there's a lot of people already running through your hometown. And I do find it interesting. Things seem to be ramping up way sooner than ever before.
I'm thinking to myself, this election is a year and a half away.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a 19th guy entered yesterday, and they're all running on the same thing. You know, this I think some sort of love platform or something, because they can't run on the economy. And they come here, and I, oh my gosh, the pleas for money are just, you know, just send me a dollar, and we'll get rid of this bad guy. Everything is a pitch. Elizabeth Warren's got, hey, go to my website and read my review of Game of Thrones. Why do I care about your review of a show I don't even see anyway?
Right.
Because you're going to pitch me for money, and you're going to tell me how bad Donald Trump is, and he's evil, and nobody's. I'm not hearing people, like, I hear fluff. I hear the same Obama fluff. I believe in one America, perhaps be a president for everybody. It's like, okay, that's generally how it works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, we're getting a lot of them. I think it's going to be an unbearable caucus season next year.
I don't disagree.
Yeah. I think there will still be quite a few still left in the race. I don't know how many are going to be dropping out, you know, between now and say February or January. Yeah. In the next 10 months, I don't know how many are going to be dropping out, but there might be 10 of them vying for attention still a year from now.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Now, did you hear that Joe Biden was going to be entering this week? Or did I just dream that last night?
No, I think they said he's going to throw something into the ring. I don't know, his hat. Is it a hair piece? I'm not sure what he's throwing in there. Yeah, and you know, it's kind of funny to me to think that of all the people running, he's the least radical, and probably the most sensible. And that's not necessarily saying a lot, because I find him kind of comical. You know, they think Trump says funny things. I go, Joe Biden says funny things all the time, mm-hmm. and half of them aren't even his.
But he's more in the middle, isn't he? Wouldn't he be pulling the Democrats a little bit closer to the middle with his?
I think they're going to pull him to the left first.
They're going
to
try, but I don't know will he go?
I don't know. I'm wondering if he will he'll survey the landscape and say, you know, I can't go that far left, because if you go that far left, you can't get back to the center for the general election. And that's, I think, for any of these people running, their biggest challenge is going to be, okay, during your primaries, you are running on free stuff for everybody, for everything, open the borders, let everybody in, free college, free, you name it. We're going to pay off your loans. We're going to do it all. And you're going to get into a debate with a Trump who's going to say, you can't do that. And I don't think they can just run on this, you know, we're going to raise the taxes to the sky and it's going to be amazing. We're going to pay for everything for everybody. I'm wondering if Biden will just look at it and say, you can't come back from going that far out, because
mm-hmm.
people aren't going to believe you. And the followers that you gathered along the way, I mean, they say part of the reason Hillary lost is the Bernie supporters were so upset, you know, because the Democrats went with the more centrist candidate.
Right. That they stayed home.
They stayed home because his far left followers are saying, nope, not interested. I want far left. So you can't go back to the center.
Yeah. Oh, it's so interesting. And it will be probably, like you say, very interesting next 16 months or so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, you got spring going on there, right?
Yeah, it's rainy. It's rainy here in the Twin Cities today, but it's going to be really nice this week.
Yeah, it's going to be nice. I got an ant problem. I got an ant problem. You ever have ants just come?
How is that my concern?
Well, I mean, maybe you have some advice for me. I don't know if you've noticed this. Do you ever notice that you just try to get them in the sink? Have you noticed that that's when the ants start to freak out?
When you get them in the sink? No.
When they're in the sink, I tell you, I think they know. I think inside their little ant brains, they're going, oh, no, not the jacuzzi.
Not the faucet. Not the jacuzzi.
Not the jacuzzi. You go get that bug spray. That's fast. It's pretty painless. Go get a bounty. I'll take my chances with the squish. My cousin Carl broke two legs. He could still function. I'll take my chances with the paper towel, but not the jacuzzi. You don't know what it's like down there. I don't know why.
Makes me laugh. Patrick, thanks so much for being on the show. As always, I enjoy our conversations, as do many others. Have a great day.
Thanks, you too.
Yep. Patrick Albanese has been my guest. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. Sheila Heen is my guest today. She is the founder of Triad Consulting Group and a lecturer on law at Harvard Law School. I guess that's pretty cool. She has spent the last 20 years with the Harvard Negotiation Project, and we're going to talk today about difficult conversations. We all have them. We all need to have them. We're all going to have them. Sheila, welcome back to the show.
Well, I am delighted to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. That pretty much translates into you're doing this for free.
Yeah. So far, this isn't such a hard conversation.
It's not so far. But I do want to talk about difficult conversations because you're the expert and we all have them and we're all going to have them. And it's smart if we have a framework for understanding how to go about them.
Yeah. So one of the things that has been interesting for us to learn over the years is the extent to which all difficult conversations really have the same underlying structure in terms of what we're all thinking and feeling in the midst of them, which is kind of interesting, right? Because we have them in all different directions in our lives with our family members and at work and with our neighbors and with our accountant or whatever, right? With your dog.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting that you're actually preoccupied with the same things in all those different contexts.
Sheila, can I interrupt for a minute?
Yeah.
Isn't it based on anyone's basic threshold for what they consider difficult or hard to talk about?
It is. So what we tend to say is that if a conversation feels difficult to you, if it's keeping you up at night or you've tried having it and it never seems to work, like, or go where you need it to go, that qualifies.
Okay. See, when I have a difficult conversation, I'm only willing to have it when I know I'm going to get the outcome I want.
Right. And if you're like most people, you're probably not going to attempt to have it unless you're pretty sure that you're right.
Okay. Yeah.
Right?
You go in there with your case pretty well prepared and you think that this is going to come out good, and it usually doesn't.
It usually doesn't. And by the way, there's also a whole other category, which is I didn't want to have this conversation, but I got ambushed by this conversation.
Oh,
so
yeah.
those are in this bucket also.
You leave me out of this one.
Yeah, exactly. Like a conversation just walked in my door that I was not even expecting today. So in terms of what we're preoccupied with, there are sort of three categories of things that we're thinking and feeling in the midst of these messy situations. And if you can understand that underlying structure, it just gives you some landmarks to navigate. So the first category is what we call the what happened part of the conversation. So I have a theory about what has happened and what is happening right now and what should happen in the future. And that theory, that story that I have, has three pieces, key pieces to it. The first is, what am I right about? And that's a very long list, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
always. Uh-huh. Whether or not I'm ambushed. The second is, whose fault is it that we're in the middle of this mess and that we're having this difficult conversation? And that's often you. That's your fault, but meaning the other person's. But sometimes it's actually I'm mad at myself, and that doesn't necessarily make it easier, right? And then the third key part of the story is, why are they acting this way? You know, they just have to have their way. They're controlling. They're selfish. They don't get it. They're naive. I have to have some explanation for why the other person is being so unreasonable or doesn't already agree with me. So that story that we tell, which we call the what happened conversation, those are three key pieces. And by the way, if we're in the midst of a conversation with each other, you're also thinking about what you're right about and whose fault it is
mm-hmm.
and why I'm being so difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so that's one bucket of things. There are two more things going on that we often don't think about, which is the second one is feelings. Like, what do I do with all of the strong and often conflicted feelings that I feel? I'm frustrated. I'm confused. I feel taken advantage of. I feel guilty. I'm lonely. I'm sad that it's come to this. I feel anxious about the future. Like, I often have a really confusing bundle of conversation or feelings going on in the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to figure out what to do with them, particularly in a professional context where I'm not really supposed to be having feelings.
Yeah.
Right? And then the last is what we call the identity conversation, because if a conversation feels difficult to you, chances are there's something it suggests about you that feels like it's at stake. Like, Am I not being a team player? Am I not a good parent? Am I not as valued as I thought I was? Am I competent? Am I a good person? And those can feel like they're on the table and at stake, which is part of what drives the anxiety about the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting because in any difficult conversation in your life, if you reflect on what's going on for each person internally, those kinds of things show up. People are preoccupied with those three categories of things, whether we're aware of it or not. So there's the framework, but then the question becomes, so what?
Yeah.
Right? Why does that help me? And the reason it helps us is that there really isn't a good way for me to have a productive conversation if I'm still preoccupied with what I'm right about and why this is your fault,
mm-hmm.
Et cetera. So actually, the reason it's helpful is that once I understand that the first conversation I need to have is really a conversation with myself. Like, can I shift what I'm preoccupied with from what I'm right about to getting curious about why we see this so differently? Like, it's so obvious that I'm right. Why wouldn't you agree with me? Like, what is it? What's going on?
Yeah.
But if I actually can genuinely get curious, like, so why would you think that that's a good idea? Because it seems so obvious to me that it's not a good idea, or it isn't fair
mm-hmm.
if we do it that way, or it's not going to work. And if I can shift from blame to the first shift is sort of from certainty about what I'm right about to curiosity. The second shift inside that story would be from blame to what we call joint contribution. So what did we each contribute to this? It's not necessarily things that we did wrong, but it might be things that didn't help and that got us to where we're at, because that tells us what would we have to change to handle this differently in the future. And then the third is to let go of being sure I know why you're being so idiotic and misguided, to just speak to the impact that your behavior is having and leave the question of your intentions. I don't know what your intentions were, but you know, one of the impacts of the conversation that we had last week in front of the client is that I think that they are wondering whether, you know, they should go with us
mm-hmm.
or whether we have a clear vision for what we're proposing to them. So we talk about the impact rather than talk about intentions. Like, that's different than, I don't know why you insist on undermining me in front of the client all the time. That is less likely to produce a good conversation.
Yeah, I would imagine so. So it's probably important to remember that you think you might know how someone feels or what they're trying to say, but there's a good chance you don't.
Yeah, or why they're being the way they're being. So we infer people's intentions from the impact that they have on us. Like, if I felt undermined last week,
mm-hmm.
then I figured, well, you just wanted to be controlling.
Yeah. Is it right? Because our brains can't help it, Sheila? And they start filling in details? Whether their details are true or not?
Yeah, I think that is a big part of it. I think that is a big part of it. And plus, we walk through the world wanting to know why people are acting the way that they're acting, because it helps us know how to navigate them,
mm-hmm.
right? So we're really incented to have a story pretty quickly about people. Like, if you don't say hi to me in the hall, I think to myself, you know, well, were you just preoccupied, or do you hate me now? Or were you being stuck up, or you were being aloof or something like that? And I think we're kind of wired that way. And we don't even notice that we jump to conclusions about people's intentions and feelings.
Yeah. I mean, what about if at work, instead of people saying to you, hi, Sheila, after 6 months of working there, they go, hey, you, how you doing? And you go, I still don't think they know my name.
Right. And you think to yourself, am I not important enough to them? Am I not, they clearly don't value me.
Mm-hmm.
They hardly even see me. They've been actively ignoring me. And I'm starting to not just tell a story about what does this suggest about me, which actually we should start to wonder, right? But now we're also like, why am I invisible to people around here? Is this feedback?
Hmm. Yeah, right.
But we're also now starting to tell a story about them, right? They think that they're so high and mighty and, you know, don't care about other people and don't value the work that I do.
We're so messed up.
Well, and the problem is that we get ourselves, like, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, mm-hmm. right? And so we try to have a conversation with them to explain why the fact that they don't value our work is a problem for us. But they're like, what? What do you mean I don't value your work? Right? Mm-hmm. So we're each speaking from inside our own story about what we're right about, and we're just talking past each other.
Yeah. Boy, that is right spot on. So we do not take the time, or we don't fully understand another person's perspective or their side of the story. What are we doing wrong when it comes to difficult conversations?
Yeah, well, you know, I think that one of the things that is easy to assume is that my job in the conversation, like what I'm trying to achieve, is I'm trying to explain to you why I'm right.
Mm-hmm.
And so my purpose is to get you to see that I'm right and to agree with me.
Right.
And first of all, whether or not that will ever happen, which is maybe unlikely, our first thing is to really shift to have a different purpose. Like, at least in this conversation, let's figure out why we see it so differently.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
You know, I feel like, you know, I was surprised that you didn't invite us to the holidays and hurt by that. And I'm just
wanna, you always want to bring
curious.
That. You always bring that cake that nobody wants to eat. So we just stopped inviting you.
I thought you liked that cake.
No, nobody likes that cake. And we don't.
I hate that cake.
I hate that cake.
I was only making it because I thought that you were expecting me to bring it.
Yeah, see, we're all misunderstanding each other now.
We're all misunderstanding each other. And so, I mean, you know, we're joking around. But I think sometimes we actually discover, oh, actually, I was misunderstanding. Or I thought I was being helpful, but clearly I hurt your feelings or whatever. And we sort some things out pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to also be careful that we're not saying everything's a misunderstanding and everybody has good intentions and, you know, there is no right and wrong. There are definitely versions and understandings that are more and less reasonable. But a first step is, like, help me understand why you see it the way that you see it, or what mm-hmm. you're looking at, what you're reacting to, and what I'm doing that maybe is contributing to the problem that I'm not even aware I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can have that conversation first, that's our we actually learn something, and we have a better sense of what the problem is that maybe needs to be solved between us.
Yeah. Now, Sheila, I really appreciate the framework you've given us for difficult conversations. Now I would like to shift the focus to a little bit of the profile of the person who succeeds well with difficult conversations, because you're so calm and you're so well measured with what you say. What if I've just got a very short attention span, I'm a little hot-headed, and you put those two together? That's not a good recipe for dealing with difficult conversations very well.
Well, you're right, it's not, and that's part of the challenge of difficult conversations, which goes to that feelings and identity piece,
mm-hmm.
because even the most unflappable among us can get flapped.
Oh, yeah.
Have you noticed that?
Oh, yeah, I've been flapped many
times. With the right person,
yes.
With the right person and the uh-huh. right topic on the table,
yes.
That calm starts to get disrupted. And so part of getting skillful about difficult conversations is recognizing more quickly, like, oh, I'm hooked. Like, I can feel it. Like, I can feel my heart starting to race. I can feel I'm flushing. I cannot believe that they just said that.
Mm-hmm.
And choosing my purpose for how I want to respond rather than just reacting.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking, okay, what is important to me here, and what am I trying to achieve with how I want to respond? Which is not, by the way, to say that I'm always in great shape to have the conversation.
Right.
I think there are times where I'm much better off. We're both better off if I say, okay, you know what? I think I need to take a walk. I want to think about what just happened, and I want to sit down and talk about it tomorrow or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because part of the skill to develop is in thinking about when not to have the conversation and just being a little more self-aware of really have the capacity to have it, right?
Yeah. Sheila, let me take a break. Sheila Heen is my guest, and why not? We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. I've got Sheila Heenan on our studio line. She's the founder of Triad Consulting Group, lecturer on law at Harvard Law School, and has spent the last 20 years with the Harvard Negotiation Project. We're talking about difficult conversations, and she's the expert and my go-to person when it comes to figuring out how best to do this, because I think it's something we all struggle with. And anytime we're in a difficult conversation, what's immediately at danger is our self-image and our emotions. And we take everything so personally. We respond to just about, we interpret everything that we get about us, don't we, Sheila?
Oh, we do, really quickly, really quickly. And we worry, like, am I being an interesting enough guest? Am I giving understandable answers? Am I making any sense?
Yes, yes,
like,
yes.
That whole conversation
Three
is
yeses.
Happening in my head
I
as we talk.
Yeah, I get it.
Yeah.
And you're, you know, a Harvard person, and I'm just a radio guy, so I'm going, am I asking interesting enough questions to keep you interested?
Right. And so this is the challenge between us, which is that we're having a conversation with each other, but we're having a conversation with your audience about something that we all are challenged by and we're all trying to understand and navigate
mm-hmm.
in our lives, right? And for me, part of what helps me in the midst of it is just trying to remember that from an identity point of view, I am still a child of God, and the extent that I'm wondering, am I a good person or am I worthy? The answer is, well, yes and no. I'm at least loved,
mm-hmm.
right? Whether or not I was worthy of that. And by the way, remembering that so is the other person that I'm having a hard time with. For all of their brokenness or all of their challenging personality or ways in which they don't get it, they're still also loved.
Mm-hmm.
And so that may or may not mean I need to be in relationship with them. And we may or may not be able to work through this, but it's just a basic groundedness in that helps for me.
Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking of a Sheryl Crow song that says the first cut is the deepest. So sometimes when I start a conversation and it's on the difficult side, I always say you don't really write anything, you just rewrite stuff. Because, you know, you might write something and then you have to rewrite it, right? And sometimes I say stuff, but I always have to re-say it or continue it, part two of a conversation you start. But however you begin could be where the thing either is destined for success or failure, because that first cut, the first thing you say in a difficult conversation, is that important or am I just making this up in my head?
Oh, that is so important. In fact, there are two things you're saying that are really important. One is that most difficult conversations are not one-shot deals, right? They're conversations we're going to have over time.
Yes.
But the second is that how we start each episode of those conversations over time really matters. So there's a ton of research about this, that the first 3 minutes or so has a high predictability for how the conversation will end. And so part of the trick of how to start a conversation is not to start it only inside your own story.
Say more about that, Sheila, because I find that fascinating, but I don't know what you mean.
So if we're colleagues and I am really annoyed by what you did last week.
I don't know why.
One way for me to start the conversation.
I was right.
What do you mean you don't know why?
Well,
okay,
I
Bill,
was right.
So we need to sit down and talk about why, once again,
Here we go.
You insisted
on
taking credit for the project, and in addition to that, dominated the conversation.
Okay.
And, you know, we've talked about this before, and I don't know why you don't get it. So let's just pause. How's this going for you?
Not good at all. This is not working at all. Matter of fact, I might cut this interview off right here. I'm so offended.
Right, exactly. You're about to hang up on me? So the mistake I'm making is that I am starting this conversation totally inside my own story.
Okay.
You know, I'm right that you're the one who acted badly. I know what kind of person you are, et cetera. You're to blame for this whole situation.
Mm-hmm.
And so in my story, I'm the victim, as well as the hero, by the way, and you are the villain.
Okay.
And that's just not a conversation you really want to be in.
That's going to go
nowhere. Yeah, no, thank you. No, thank you. So if I want to start the conversation differently, one way I could do it is, of course, to be in your story, but that's not a place any of us want to be. So so instead, I can start it from what we call the third story.
Uh-huh.
To say, so Bill, I want to sit down. I'd love to talk about this because last week something happened that has happened a whole bunch of times before, and I'm just trying to figure out what's going on. So when we were in the meeting last week with the client and with our boss, a couple things happened that have happened before. So one was that I felt like the airtime between us was not even, and also we had agreed ahead of time what we would each cover, and then you jumped in to cover a couple things that I thought I was prepared to step in and cover. And the second was, I think they were left with the impression, whether it was intentional or not, I don't know. I'm guessing it probably wasn't. But I think that because of the way you closed, you left with the impression that sort of you were the driving force, which was surprising to me and a little upsetting to me. And I'm wondering what's going on between us that we keep landing in that place that isn't really working for me. But I'm curious, what was, looking back on that meeting, talk to me about what was going on from your point of view.
Okay, I'm not in the least bit mad right now or threatened by what you just said.
Well, that's because you're a better person than the Bill that I was talking to. But yes.
No, but I mean, you handled that so well. So I'm thinking I might be saying something like, well, I got kind of on a roll in that meeting and they were buying sort of what I was saying and I wanted to keep the momentum going. And sorry if I stepped on your toes. I didn't mean to. You know, maybe next time I'll just try to be more aware of our contributions in the meeting.
Yeah, so it sounds like also you were worried that we would lose momentum if you handed it off.
I was afraid of that.
So now we're starting to sort of talk about what happened that I'm giving you the benefit of the doubt that it wasn't intentional, but I'm also not saying it's not a problem.
Uh-huh.
And so what I'm doing with that opening is basically saying, I want to talk about what went wrong. I want to understand your perspective, and I want to share what the problem is from my point of view. So now both of our stories have a legitimate place in that conversation.
Okay.
And nobody's the villain necessarily.
Yeah.
Instead, we're partners to try to figure it out together, and that's an invitation that you're much more likely to take.
Okay. Now, Sheila, how often do people adapt this style? Every time I hear of stories, there's always a villain. There's always someone that was like, oh, this guy really messed up.
Yeah, well, so you're right. I do think that our stories naturally have heroes, villains, and victims.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the easiest template in our heads to tell the story. And this actually requires us to shift to say, in some ways, we're both victims, and in some ways, we have the potential to both be heroes here, if I can invite you as my partner to try to figure out what's going on. And at the end of the day, I may make my own decisions about whether to stay in this story with you. But we're really offering the other person a different role.
Mm-hmm.
And if you listen to some of the best negotiators out there, if you pick someone in your life who you really admire and pay attention, this is one of the things that you'll notice that they're doing. And they're often doing it instinctively. Which is that they're offering the other person a role that the other person likes and that is not dishonest. It's not like, let's pretend that you're something other than you are.
Mm-hmm. Sheila, it's really easy to accuse someone, isn't it?
And it's so satisfying.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
it's satisfying until they respond.
Right.
Right? Because they're going to fight back and say, no, I'm not the problem here. You're the one who's the problem. You're oversensitive and, you know, you don't really get the client anyway. So I couldn't let you take the ship down, right? So if I keep you as the villain, you're going to fight back with your story. And in your story, I'm the one who's the problem or the villain or clueless.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why actually things escalate between us, because it's a fight of my story versus your story and whose story is right.
Yeah. Well, I want to invite you back to the Christmas gathering. Just don't bring the cake. And so we've done good with each other today. And then also, just to let our listeners know, go to stoneandheen.com. Is that still the best place to go buy books that you've written?
I think it is. It is. And you can find them at any bookseller, Amazon.
Yeah, Amazon.
Your local bookstore.
Yes.
Et cetera.
And
yeah.
Your spell your last name, H-E-E-N, Sheila Heen, just to let people know, even though I know. So just so you know that I know.
Yeah, thank you for that.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for doing the show. Always nice to talk to you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and
absolutely.
This is...
It's great to talk to you.
Thanks.
And,
was this
know,
a difficult conversation?
It was a really fun conversation.
No, was
as it,
it
always
was
is.
It difficult? Was it difficult?
It wasn't difficult.
Oh, good.
You asked great questions.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.